In the middle of a study, well, toward the end of a study now, of, oddly enough, one of my favorite characters of the Old Testament. And the reason he's one of my favorite characters is because of how he starts. Unfortunately, there's a lot of his story that doesn't end as well as I would like it to end. Now, sometime along that point, he writes Proverbs and Song of Solomon and a little book called Ecclesiastes. And my guess is he writes Ecclesiastes right at the end of his life, as he maybe is hopefully, at least I want to think, figuring some things out about his relationship with God. But Solomon is going to have some acts of defiance. I found it interesting that we're not going to have children's church today, because we may get some children that have some acts of defiance today. We may hear a phrase like, "Mine." And we may see some kids who don't want to mind mom and dad. And so I'm reminded of a story when I first started preaching. We lived in Little Clayton, New Mexico, and some of our closest friends were Jeff and Sheila Harris, and they had three children. And their middle one, to use the words of Jeff, was a little stink pot. Now, I'm not quite sure what a little stink pot is, but little Denton was one. Denton's got his own kids now, which I find highly entertaining. But we were on our way to go see a movie in Amarillo. And so we're making that journey from Clayton to Amarillo in their Suburban. And little Denton from the very back seat is told to do something. And Denton shouts out, "I'm not going to do it, and you can't make me." Now, for those of you that had Suburbans 25 years ago, you know that you had a button that would roll the back window down in the Suburban so you could load groceries. So Jeff pulls over, slams on the brakes, and rolls down the back window all in one motion. Slams on the brakes, so we're going 70 miles an hour, and he skids to the side of the road while he's rolling down the window, and he's out the back of that Suburban and through the window that he's opened, and he grabs little Denton by the scruff of his shirt, because we wouldn't say scruff of his neck, although there might have been scruff of neck, and he yanks him out, and he has this talk that nobody else hears. And then he places little Denton back in that back seat, and I look, and this is Denton. And his defiance was quickly met. I wish Solomon's defiance would have been quickly met. Because Solomon's story breaks my heart. But yet when I read Solomon's story, I see the greatness in the asking from chapter 3, and I see how he wanted to so build a temple for God, and how he wanted to do all of these things to honor the God that he served, but there were just moments that he shook his fist at God. And then I got to thinking, do I ever do the same thing? Are there moments in my life, are there things going on in my life where maybe I don't proverbially shake my fist at God, but are there moments when I say, I don't necessarily think I need to do that? And it's one thing if we do it to a speed limit, and it's one thing if we do it to a doctor, and it's one thing if we even maybe do it to a spouse, but what about when we do it to God? Before we read Solomon's story, I'm reminded of what Paul said in Galatians 6, and he writes this. He says, "Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows." Okay, I find that to be a haunting passage. Now, we've all heard that phrase, you reap what you sow. Even if people don't know the Bible, they use that phrase. You know what? The stuff you put in, that's going to be some of the stuff that you get out. And when you act bad, you're going to get bad results. Maybe a different section of our world would use a word like karma, that karma is what happens, and you kind of get what you get because of the way you acted. And Solomon is going to get what he's going to get. Because the truth is you can't mock God. You can't ignore God without consequence. And I think that is the lesson we need to take from this story. Because no one, including Solomon, who is the richest, wisest, most important man in his world at that day, he cannot ignore God without consequence. And if he can't do it, then neither can we. And so we need to learn a little bit from him. Now, Solomon should have learned this from David. There were at least a couple of instances in David's life. And again, we've talked about this. One of the things the Bible does better than any other book is it paints its heroes in all of their colors, good, bad, and indifferent. And there were a couple of moments in David's life where David should have learned you can't just directly disobey God and get away with it. Solomon didn't seem to learn that. And his act of defiance is not one of ignorance. It's one of shaking his fist at God. You know, there are mistakes I make that are mistakes of ignorance. There are moments when I do something that maybe I just didn't know I shouldn't do or I didn't realize I did it. But Solomon very openly says, here is what I'm going to do, and I'm willing to box with God about it. And Solomon's arm is not long enough, nor is yours, to try to box with God. And so we got to come to terms with something. And in the church world that we live in, I don't know if we come to terms with this as much as we should, but we've got to come to terms with God is gracious, yes, but he is also righteous. Okay, you've heard me say, and probably every sermon that you have ever heard me preach, I hope you have always heard a message of grace. That in it you've heard about forgiveness, and you've heard about God's love, and you've heard about God's mercy, and how God sent his son to pay for our sins. I hope you've always heard that from here. But you also need to hear that not only is God gracious, but God is righteous as well. And those two things go hand in hand. And you can't ignore God and get away with it. So we get this story. 1 Kings chapter 11. Here's where we started or finished last week. Let's start there. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do this in your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son, yet I will not tear out the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant, for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So there's that line that we finished with last week. He's going to tear this out. He'll say in verse 13, here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to tear the whole thing out because I made a promise to David. But Solomon is out of God's favor. That he has shaken his fist, so to speak. He has tried to box with God and has learned that he's not going to get away with it. And what happens with Solomon is he reaps what he sows. And at least two things happen. The first thing that happens is the defiance that Solomon shows toward God jeopardizes his dynasty. Okay, now Solomon is going to go into this with the promise of David that you're always going to have someone on the throne. And by the end of Solomon's life, he's told by the prophet, by God, you're not going to have anybody on the throne except for this one little tribe that's left that's here in Jerusalem. And everybody else is going to be taken away. And Solomon gets immediately a taste of what is coming. Because what happens to Solomon is God, and the phrase is he raises up. And I think that's an interesting phrase that appears in the midst of the story. But God raises up both an external and an internal threat. And so it's almost like God is saying, okay, Solomon, you have shaken your fist at me, and you have looked at me and said, I'm not willing to do what you've asked me to do. And so God is going to say, I'm going to remove this from you, and you're not going to have all the glory that you had before, and your story is going to kind of end lousy. But because of David, I'm going to give you one tribe left, but I'm going to start this long before you're ever dead. And we get these two threats. The external threats come from two individuals. So let's just read their story. And you're going to have to pardon me. I don't read Hebrew names very well. And so I don't know why Hebrew people name their kids with weird names. But they will in a second. So let's just read 1 Kings 11. Then the Lord, so he's pronounced judgment. Then the Lord raised up against Solomon an adversary, Hadad the Edomite, from the royal line of Edom. Earlier, when David was fighting with Edom, Joab, the commander of the army, had gone up to bury the dead and struck down all the men of Edom. Joab and all the Israelites stayed there for 6 months until they had destroyed all the men of Edom. So we're getting a little bit of a history lesson. So the writer of 1 Kings is saying, okay, here are the bad guys that David dealt with. Okay, there are these men of Edom. But Hadad, still only a boy, fled to Egypt with some Edomite officials who had served his father. They set out from Midian and went to Paran, and then taking from Paran with them, they went to Egypt to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, who had gave Hadad a house and land and provided him with food. Okay, let's just stop there and read a little and preach a little. Remember Solomon's very first act of marriage, at least that we read about? Remember who he married? We get to chapter 3, verse 1 of 1 Kings, and it says Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter. What's intriguing is maybe 30 years later, after Solomon has married Pharaoh's daughter, we're going to get Pharaoh coming back on the scene, and the financer of the bad guy that's going to rage against Solomon is nothing other than Pharaoh, at least it appears. So Pharaoh was so pleased, verse 19 reads, with Hadad, that he gave him a sister of his own wife, Queen Tophanes. Now, if I said that wrong, I hope she'll forgive me. The sister of Tophanes bore him a son named, let's just call him G, whom Tophanes brought up in the royal palace. Then G lived with Pharaoh's own children. While he was in Egypt, Hadad heard that David rested with his ancestors, okay, i.e. he died, and that Joab, the commander of the army, was also dead. And then Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Let me go that I may return to my own country." Pharaoh says, "What have you lacked that you want to go back to your own country?" "Nothing," Hadad replies, "but let me go." And God raised up against Solomon another adversary. So Hadad goes back to be a thorn in Solomon's flesh, bolstered by Pharaoh. And God raised up against Solomon another adversary, Rezon, son of, I want to say Elida, but I know that's not how you say it, but that's just the town down the road, who had fled from his master Hadadezer, king of Zorba. When David destroyed Zobah's army, Rezon gathered a band of men around him and became their leader. And they went to Damascus, where they settled and took control. And Rezon was Israel's adversary as long as Solomon lived, adding to the trouble caused by Hadad. So very late in Solomon's reign, he has done the right things at the beginning. He's asked God for wisdom, and God has blessed him with riches, and God has blessed him with honor, and God has given him that wisdom. And now this whole story starts to turn, and God provides these two external threats. What's sad is these external threats were no match for David. David didn't have any trouble dealing with Edom. David didn't have any trouble dealing with the other nations around him that would give him fits. But yet Solomon makes a compromise at the beginning with Pharaoh, and before you know what, all the stuff starts to fall like dominoes. He's the wisest, mightiest man in the world, and he cannot seem to deal with two worthless rebels. And maybe the reason he couldn't deal with two worthless rebels is because of that opening line. Remember, the opening line said, "The Lord raised up." And so here at the end of Solomon's life, he is getting this little taste of what it means to box with God. But there's also an internal threat. So you've got these two characters, these kind of two rebellious characters from the outside of Israel that are putting pressure on Solomon. But then we're going to get another character who's putting pressure on Solomon from inside of the nation. And so we get an internal threat. So we keep reading verse 26, and we'll read a little, preach a little. Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. Okay, we don't know what rebelled against the king entails, but it's probably pretty bad, it's my guess. He was one of Solomon's officials, so he's in the cabinet, an Ephraimite from Zereda, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. And here is the account of how he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the terrace and had filled the gap in the wall of the city of David, his father. Now Jeroboam was a man of standing. And when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the tribes of Joseph. So basically, he's in charge of filling the gaps in the wall of the city of David. About that time, Jeroboam was going out to Jerusalem, and Ahijah, the prophet of Shiloh, met him on the way wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. So anytime you get this little object lesson, we ought to pay attention. So he takes this new cloak and he tears it into 12 pieces, and then he said to Jeroboam, "Take 10 pieces for yourself, For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David, we've kind of heard these words before, for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. I will do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashereth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Molech, the gods of the Ammonites. Let's pause right there. Remember, one of God's big commandments was don't worship the gods of the Canaanites? Well, if you were going to list the gods of the Canaanites in their order of importance, the big three would be these three. And Solomon is worshiping every single one of them. Not a good sign. So he has not walked in obedience to me, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my decrees as the laws of David, Solomon's father, did. But I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand, for I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose, who obeyed my decrees. Now notice what's going to happen with old Jeroboam. I will take my kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. And I will give one tribe to his son, so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. However, as for you, I will take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you, and you walk in obedience to me, and do what is right in my eyes by obeying my decrees and commands, as David, my servant, did, not Solomon, David, I will be with you, and I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David. And I will give Israel to you, and I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever. And then notice the last line. Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to where? Egypt. So in our first story, our external threat, Egypt almost seems to be the financer of Hadad. And now here is Jeroboam, and he's going to run to Egypt as well. And Egypt, whom Solomon tried to make peace with early in his reign, is now part of the instigators upon Israel's future. Remember at the very beginning of our study, we said Solomon's name means peace. That was the whole point of why he was the one who got to build the temple. Remember, God said, David, I don't want you to build the temple because you've been a man of war, but your son Solomon, he is going to be a man of peace. And the last years of his reign is nothing but war because Solomon has lost God's favor. So defiance jeopardized his dynasty, but it also diminished his legacy. See, we want to remember Solomon for the first few years of his life. We go back to chapter 3 and we heard these words at the very beginning of our study. I will give you whatever you ask, both wealth and honor. And he's going to get wisdom. That we know God has honored that. And Solomon is this story of what could have been. Now we all probably have stories of people and what could have been. Okay, my favorite athlete as a kid growing up was a guy by the name of Bo Jackson, who played both football and baseball. And one of my favorite books I've ever read was his biography, where they're telling stories about his athletic prowess. And he was a guy that couldn't be stopped in high school, couldn't be stopped in college, and to be frankly honest, couldn't be stopped even later on in the pros until his hip blew up. And the question that came out of that was, what could have been? He could have been the greatest ever. He could have made the Hall of Fame in baseball and made the Hall of Fame in football. He could have been all of these things. And the story about Solomon has got to be the story of what could have been. I think when we could have talked about the kings of Israel, we could have said David was the greatest and Solomon was just like him. But that's not what it was. Solomon is not mentioned as one of the greatest kings of Israel. Solomon is not mentioned within the same breath of his father David. Solomon is not praised at the city gates. If anything, we get to the end of the story of his life and we say, what a guy. I mean, he had it all and he had everything that God had blessed him with, and he chose to shake his fist at God and do his own thing. And Solomon loses all the honor that he might have had before. What's interesting is Solomon also is going to lose all of his wealth. Now, maybe not directly in his own life, but we're going to see this. In the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak. Okay, notice who he's king of. Back to Egypt again. Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem, and he carried off all the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace, and he took everything. Okay, remember, we kind of talked about what Solomon did for the temple and what Solomon did for the palace and the gold and the wood and the ivory and the curtains and everything that was so amazing. And within just a few short years of Solomon's death, he loses all of that. Okay, I'm assuming that Solomon will die around the age of 60. The writer is going to say he reigned for 40 years. And to be 60 and die was probably pretty young at that day. And in the midst of that, through his idol worship and idolatry and bringing the Canaanite gods into Israel's life, oddly enough, he sows the seed for the destruction of his greatest work. We talked about how his greatest work was the building of the Temple Mount and the temple there in Jerusalem. And a few hundred years later, idolatry is going to haunt Jerusalem and Judah and Israel for the rest of their lives, and it will be destroyed. And then we get this little summary, and I find it to be haunting. As for the other events of Solomon's reign, all that he did, the wisdom he displayed, are they not written in the book of the annals of Solomon? And Solomon reigned in Jerusalem for 40 years. It's almost, maybe I'm reading too much into this, it's almost like the writer of 1 Kings is saying, God didn't think it worth mentioning what Solomon did with the rest of his time. He shook his fist at God. And he got angry and did his own thing, and he rebelled, and the rest of his story is not even told. Okay, I do not want that to be my story. And I don't want that to be your story. I don't want your story to start in this blessedness and this story to start where you hand your life over to God and this story that says, I'm going to do whatever you ask God and I'm going to display it. Let's put it in church context. I'm going to display it by confessing your name and being baptized, and I'm going to draw a line in the sand that says, at this moment, I am yours forever, and then us walk away from that. Because more than anything, I want to see us finish strong. And Solomon doesn't finish strong. Solomon will write this at some point in chapter 4 of Proverbs. He will put these words there. Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. I wish Solomon would have heeded his own proverb, that Solomon would have guarded his heart. Or maybe to heed the prayer of Psalm 86, where the psalmist says, teach me your way, O Lord, that I may rely on your faithfulness, and give me an undivided heart that I may fear your name. I want to live by those two verses. I want to live by Solomon saying in Proverbs 4, you guard your heart because from that comes everything else. And I want to live by what the psalmist says, that I can have an undivided heart, that I understand and fear who God is. And I want that all the days of my life. I don't want it here and there, and I don't want it just at the beginning, because I want to finish strong. Okay, I love watching the Olympics. They kind of drove me nuts this last time, but I like watching the longer races because something interesting always happens. In the longer races, you always get kind of the rabbit that gets up in the front, and he kind of sets the pace, and he just runs as fast as he can for a little while, and then he peters out. And about the time he peters out, the real guy that's about to win the gold medal will pass him. And that little rabbit that kind of set the context earlier, before you know it, he's back at the very, very end. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the one who starts out saying, God is good and he is great and look at what he's done. And I'm leading the pack in the race and I'm running full force for all that I've got only to finish in last place. I want to finish strong. And as I've been preaching through this story of Solomon, and as I've read his story over and over and over, my hero is not finishing strong, and it hurts to watch. It's painful. It's painful to see someone who you see has got so much going on and is going the right direction at the beginning and is saying and doing almost all of the right things, but before you know it, he goes from being the leader in the race to the one pulling up the back. Other day I was talking with someone from outside of our community that one of you know, and you gave me their contact and said, call him and encourage him to get back in church. And so I call him to encourage him to get back in church, and these are his exact words. I am old and retired, and I don't need that stuff anymore. Okay, some of you, my child threw you under the bus, and I'm so sorry. Some of you are old and retired. You're not old and retired from this stuff. You may be old and retired from working for the school district, or working for the city of Roswell, or working for the BLM, or being a fireman or a policeman or someone who teaches at FLETC or one of a few other hundred things that this group has done. And you may retire from that, and your hair may grow gray, and you may start to walk with a limp, but you don't retire from this. Finish strong. The hardest funerals I have to do are those who started strong and who finish weakly. Those who started their relationship with God and they said, God is great and I want to follow him and I want to do what he says, but the end of their life looks nothing like the beginning. And it's so hard for me to find the right words to say about that person to their family and to a church that knew their story. And don't make me preach that at your funeral. At your funeral, make me stand up and say, you know, they started their journey with God when they were 15, 16, 17, 28, 42, whatever it was when they started. And when they died at 75, 80, or 112, they finished just like they started. And don't be Solomon's story. So I think it's a word of warning to all of those whom God has said, I'm going to take care of you, and I'm going to save you, and I'm going to cleanse, but you finish strong. Let's go back to our Olympic image. I'm thinking of the mile. That's kind of where I always see it. It's about the end of that last little stretch on the straightaway as they're running the mile in the Olympics. There is always someone who comes from maybe third or fourth place and they make their way around and they just give it all they've got. And before you know it, they have gone from fourth place to first place and they hold their arms up and in a few moments they're going to get a gold medal. That's what I want to see in you. Paul says, I've fought the fight, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith, and now there is awaiting me a crown of righteousness that the Lord will award to me, but not only me, to all of those who have longed for his appearing. You're not going to get a gold medal, but at the end, when you run hard and strong, you're going to get a crown of righteousness. And you're going to stand with heroes of the faith, and maybe, unfortunately, be reminded of those that could have been. We're going to take another look from a different angle at Solomon's life next week that I think is a hope, a positive end to his story with Ecclesiastes. But don't be the one that could have been. So if you need me, or if you need the elders, or if you need somebody else, someone is around you that loves you, I guarantee it. Find me at the front. Find the elders as you go out the back. If you just need someone to help you run stronger, that's part of what God has called us to do. And so ask us, and we'll do our best to help you run the race God's put before you. So let's stand.